Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
You're watching a Highwire Media podcast.
Hello and welcome to today's episode of Murder Monday. This week on True Crime Never Sleeps, we dive into the Christmas slaughter. Before we do that, give me your thoughts on this topic in the comment section below. If there's any other topics you want covered, let me know. With that, let's dive right in. It was Monday, December 28th, 1987, the day after Christmas, following a long three-day holiday weekend. Everyone was shuffling back into work that gloomy gray winter morning in Russellville, Arkansas, which is a small town about an hour away from Little Rock. Among those returning to work was 24-year-old Kathy Kendrick, who had just recently started a new secretary job for the law firm Appeal, Eddie & Gibbons. At 10:16 a.m. that morning, as Secretary Kathy sat behind her desk, an older man in a straw cowboy hat entered the law office and approached her while she was talking to a client standing next to her. Now, without looking up at the man, she asked him, "Can I help you?" The older man responded by pulling a handgun from the pocket of his leather jacket, aiming it at Kathy's head, and firing five .22 caliber hollow-point bullets into her. The first shot missed, but the next four didn't. They entered Kathy's head at point-blank range. As she slumped to the ground, the man calmly turned around and walked right back out through the same front door as he had just entered, all the while without saying a word. The client, who had been talking to Kathy only a moment before, stood by and watched in horror as this all just suddenly happened right before her eyes. It was horrific. From another room, firm partner David Eddy heard the shots and raced into the lobby to find his new secretary motionless on the ground in a pool of deep, dark blood that was leaking from the multiple holes in her head. And everyone else in the lobby was visibly shaken. I mean, this man literally walked in, shot her five times, and left. The police were called right away, and as they made their way out of the law office, the older man drove down Main Street, passing the Carve local news van as it sped towards the law offices. This older man, the shooter, then parked outside Taylor Oil a mile and a half down the road. At the same time, KARV, or Carve, went live with a news brief, saying, quote, "Carve has learned that there's been a shooting at the Peel and Eddy law offices on Glenwood and Russellville. Police are hurrying to the scene at this time, and we'll keep you informed as details come in." Now, those details in that moment were still being written as the older man, our shooter down the road, pulled open the front door at Taylor Oil. Standing inside the building, the older man looked around and saw business owner Rusty Taylor inside his office, sitting at his desk. The shooter then fired two shots through the door directly at Rusty, both of which hit him in the left side of his chest. Rusty fell to the floor and crawled for cover beneath his desk. Rusty's customer, named Craig Bailey, sat just out of the gunman's view in stunned silence. Craig didn't know if he should be laughing or not. This was so surreal, he thought it had to be a joke. This man just walked in and started firing, but it wasn't. As the shooter began making his exit from the building, another man approached the entrance, unaware of what was unfolding on the other side of the door. That man was a 34-year-old firefighter named Jim Chaffin, also a part-time Taylor Oil employee who drove a bulk truck delivering oil when he wasn't on the clock at the fire department. Jim had just returned from a fire call that morning when he turned the knob, pulled the door open, and crossed paths with the older man, who, without a word or even a pause, fired one round into Jim Chaffin's brain through his right eye, killing him instantly while walking out of the store. So this man has now hit two businesses, walked in, killed people, walked out, no rhyme or reason. As Jim Chaffin fell to the ground, the older man in his cowboy hat and cowboy boots heard a rustling behind him. As if on instinct, he turned around and fired one round at 35-year-old bookkeeper Julie Money, who had just walked out of the restroom. The last thing Julie saw before feeling the bullet was the blinding white of the man's cold, twisted grin as he fired his gun at her. Julie felt the warmth and speed of the bullet against her head as it flew past her, just narrowly missing. Believing she'd been shot, though, she dropped to the ground and rolled herself behind a stack of boxes. The older man, who also believed that the bullet had hit her, turned back around, strode past the dead body of Jim, and got back into his car. As he drove away, emergency dispatch got another phone call. This one from Julie Mooney. Suddenly, local authorities in this normally sleepy town were overwhelmed by emergency calls. There was a rampaging killer on the loose. He had hit two businesses already, and he wasn't done. His next stop was a convenience store on the opposite end of Main Street, the Sinclair Mini Mart. Now, Sinclair Mini Mart, like Taylor Oil, was also owned by Rusty Taylor. And as the older man, armed with two .22 caliber pistols, walked into the convenience store, he saw store clerk Roberto Woolery standing at the window, watching as patrol cars sped past the building, racing to the Taylor Oil offices and to the law firm. So Roberto had no idea that the other two buildings nearby had already been hit by the active shooter, who was now walking into her building. The time was now about 10:40 a.m. Mini Mart manager David Saylor was in the back of the store drinking coffee with his friend, 71-year-old Tony Carter, when he happened to catch out of the corner of his eye, the older man raised his pistol and pointed his way. David ducked just down just as the gun was fired, and the bullet crashed into a video display case behind him. Now both David and Roberta recognized the gunman as a former store employee named R. Jean, who had quit his cashier job there only a week earlier, complaining that he was underpaid and overworked. Confused by what had just happened, David turned to his friend Tony and asked, "Is this for real? Is this ex-employee R. Jean literally trying to kill him right now?" The clerk on duty, Roberta, recognized also that it was R. Jean. She grabbed the phone while Tony and David ducked under a table. R. Jean, who was standing in front of the door blocking the exit, then fired two shots at Roberta, striking her in the chin and in her shoulder. As Roberta collapsed behind the counter, phone still in hand, R. Jean again turned his gun towards David, who then picked up a chair and charged towards the gunman. "Get out of here," he shouted at R. Jean, who didn't expect a proactive response from his target. The other two stores he hit, no one had come at him. R. Jean fired a shot that ricocheted off the chair and into David's head. David flung the chair at R. Jean before toppling over to the floor in a growing stream of blood. Seeing this, Tony Carter, who's 71, mind you, positioned himself near an arsenal of Coca-Cola six-packs. One by one, Tony grabbed cans from the pile and flung them at the gunman, before then hurling a whole six-pack and nearly hitting his armed assailant in the head. R. Jean kept firing, rather blindly at this point, as he was trying to duck the bombardment of cans flying in his direction. The elderly man yelled, "Get out of here," and R. Jean, realizing the growing level of risk, turned around and did just that. The other two businesses he had hit, no one had attacked him, but this one, it was now becoming harder. He got back into his car and continued on down the road. Roberto, wounded but still conscious, was able to connect with emergency dispatch. "Please hurry," she told them. "Our blood is dripping everywhere."
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Graham laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Graham keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Graham laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.
Meanwhile, R.G., not yet satisfied that he'd wounded and killed enough people, had one more stop to make, the offices of Woodline Motor Freight, which, like the Sinclair Mini Mart, was another former workplace of his. He put his .22 into a paper bag and carried it in the administrative offices, where he used the office's vibrant decorated Christmas tree as a sort of hunting blind. From behind the tree, he kept an eye out for Joyce Butts. This is the woman who had been his supervisor when he worked there. When he finally caught sight of Joyce sitting at her desk, R. Jean stepped out from behind the tree with his hands in his pocket, approached her desk, pulled out his gun, and shot her in the head and chest, all while laughing. The other seven employees in the office hit the floor as R. Jean walked into the computer room. Inside the computer room, Woodline employee Vicky Jackson turned around and saw R. Jean, her former co-worker, with the gun in his hand, raising it to her head. She dropped to the floor, expecting the worst. "Jean," she pleaded, "please don't shoot me. Jean, please don't shoot me." Suddenly, R. Jean spoke for the first time all morning. "Remember, this is the fourth business he had gone into. Vicky," he said, "get up. I'm not going to hurt you. Vicky looked up at him, her mouth hanging open. He lowered his gun. He then took the second gun out of the paper bag and laid it on her desk. "Why haven't you come down to Sinclair to see me?" Arjean asked her. "Sinclair, the store where you'd been working until a week ago." "I have," she told them, "but you weren't there." "Well, you know I work on weekends," the armed man replied. Arjean could hear the tremble in Vicky's voice and saw her hands shaking. "Do you need your cigarettes?" he asked. He picked up Vicky's cigarettes and also the gun he had just set down, handing both to her. She told him to put the gun down back on the desk. She wanted nothing to do with it, even though the thought of picking it up and shooting Arjean did briefly cross her mind. Arjean then instructed Vicky to call the police and an ambulance for Joyce. "I'm going to turn myself in, because you've never done anything to me. I came here to do what I had to do. I wanted to kill Joyce. Everything's been taken care of now." Vicky dialed the Russellville police. Once on the phone with dispatch, she told them that the gunman was with her in the office and that he wanted to give himself up. You have to imagine what police were thinking on the other end. The same gunman who had just walked into three other businesses and shot multiple people. Vicky informed them that Arjean had handed his pistols over to her and that he didn't want the police to come barging in. By this time, officers from Arkansas State Police, County Sheriff's Office, and Russellville PD had already begun to surround the building, along with armed civilians. Through Vicky, Arjean relayed to dispatch that he wanted to know what the police chief would be wearing so he could surrender to him directly. The dispatch told her the chief, Chief Herb Johnston, was wearing a blue sweater and had silver hair. Meanwhile, one of the troopers had a gun trained directly on Arjean's head through the plexiglass. But Chief Johnston stepped in front of the gun and told the trooper, "Get out of here." Then the chief, bold enough to remove his own firearm, entered the building and made his way towards the computer room. Arjean emerged with his second gun at his side. "Give me the gun," Chief told him. Arjean removed the gun from his side, handed it over. At that moment, the troopers rushed in and cuffed him. At this point, no one knew who he was, aside from the handful of co-workers who had seen him that morning. The chief asked, "Who are you? What's your name?" The man replied quietly, almost inaudible, "James Johnson." As they brought Arjean to the station, businesses in town remained on high alert. Doors bolted shut, shades drawn. No one knew yet that the shooter had been caught. All of Russellville braced for more attacks. Once at the station, investigators asked the man why he had done this, but he sat in total silence. He deflected every question. Outside, investigators began digging. They ran the plates on his car, which had been impounded, and the name came back, Ronald Gene Simmons, known to co-workers as R. Gene or just Gene. Ronald Gene Simmons was a 47-year-old retired Air Force sergeant. He had retired from a 20-year military career in 1979. He served in Vietnam, earned the Bronze Star, the Vietnam Gallantry Cross, an Air Force Marksmanship Ribbon, and other accolades. And yet, after his retirement, his life spiraled into something unimaginable. Military excellence to becoming one of the most horrific murderers in U.S. history. It's definitely a lot right out of the gate. And I'm just going to warn you now, it gets worse. And although you know what you know about Arjean now, I can tell you how much of a monster he really was. You already know about his awful acts, that he's a murderer, but murder was only the last chapter of a brutal and evil downward spiral that Arjean was about to embark on after leaving the military. Up to that point, Simmons had lived in New Mexico with his very large immediate family. Included his wife Becky, whom he met in 1957 when she was 16 and he was 17, and serving in the Navy. He then left the Navy to join the Air Force, moved to New Mexico, married Becky in 1960. Over the next 19 years until his retirement, they had 7 children, 3 sons, and 4 daughters. But after he retired, he began drinking heavily, from morning until night. Friends of his kids who came over never saw him without a beer in his hand. He'd sit on the couch and watch TV all day, or otherwise spend time by himself in a creepy, dark, foul-smelling room that no one but him was allowed to go into. He often slept there alone, so basically, this was a man cave. And Arjean had turned into a deadbeat father and husband. People in Cloudcroft, New Mexico, the town where they lived, were afraid of Arjean. He was reclusive, unfriendly, and the type of guy who would respond to casual greetings with a cold, silent glare. And this had all kind of come about since he retired. But Arjean wasn't just a lousy father. He had forced his children into a traumatic and awful home life. His home was a very dangerous place to be, and there was a family secret. one that would soon cause R. Jean to pick up his entire family and flee to Arkansas in the middle of the night, where we know he would then go on to commit this rampage. In 1981, R. Jean's eldest child, his then 19-year-old son, Ronald Jean Jr., whom everybody called Little Jean, reported his father to social services in Cloudcroft. He reported that R. Jean had been sexually abusing his younger sister. This was R. Jean's 16-year-old daughter, Sheila. Often outside the home began reporting this as well, and it soon started to become apparent that 16-year-old Sheila was pregnant. And in June 1981, she gave birth to a baby girl, who she named Sylvia. Around this time, Sheila admitted to her high school guidance counselor that the child had been fathered by her father, R. Jean. There was now a baby born of incest in the family. A criminal investigation was launched. They began trying to build a case against R. Jean, but Sheila at that point was refusing to cooperate. And this is perfectly normal for a 16-year-old daughter who had been physically abused by her own father to be scared or to not think if anything is wrong with what's going on in the house. She doesn't understand. It's been happening for years. So that was kind of putting a wrench in the efforts to charge him. When Sheila was threatened with contempt of court, she did finally agree to cooperate, and that's when she testified against her father. So they did finally enforce her, but again, you're forcing a victim to enter trauma they weren't willingly wanting to enter. It's just complicated things. Charges were then filed against him, 3 counts of incest. Once R. Jean became aware of all this, he packed everything up, took the family, and abandoned their house in the middle of the night, fleeing the state of New Mexico. So when the cops show up at R. Jean's house to arrest him for the incest charges, he was already gone. The house was vacant, the whole entire family was gone. 7 children, all of them disappeared. At the time, in 1981, R. Jean Simmons moved his family to Ward, Arkansas. He forced his wife, who desperately wanted to leave him and refused to be intimate with him on accounts of him impregnating their daughter, to stay and to help raise the incestuous child. He told his wife, quote, "You have to stay here and help raise the child that I have created with our daughter." And it was at this time that he began distancing his wife from her extended family, secluding her. He prohibited her from going out by herself. He forbade her from driving. He took away her keys. He wouldn't let her call anyone. So, I mean, he's basically taking his own wife prisoner. It was also at this point that the relationship R. Jean had forced with Sheila, his daughter, began to take a downward turn. His feelings that he had once had for her had kind of turned to rage, because he felt like Sheila had betrayed him by testifying against him and going to police. Although she did it against her will, he still felt like it was betrayal. And what's even crazier is the situation I'm explaining. I'm aware that this happens all the time. Like, this is not a one-off thing. I mean, it's a one-off thing because he went and killed a bunch of people and all these businesses, right? This home life, the abuse, isolation, incest, happens more often than we probably know, which is sad. This father who's supposed to protect you, manipulating his daughter and claiming that they were in love, and now he's turning around and saying, "You ruined my life." No, you ruined her life. In 1983, Simmons found an affordable plot of land in a tiny rural area outside Dover, Arkansas, on the fringes of Russellville. He bought a 13-acre plot of land, which came to call Mockingbird Hill. On that hill, he constructed a residence out of 2 vintage mobile homes joined together. He moved the family there, now consisting of himself, his wife, his oldest son, Elgin, and his 5 youngest children. Those conjoined mobile homes lacked running water, phone service, indoor plumbing. He built a 10-foot-high privacy fence around the home, made of salvaged wood and brick, completely isolating the property. He forced his family to use an outhouse. He filled barrels with water for bathing, laundry, and washing. He regularly beat his wife, who almost always had bruises on her face. When Elgin tried to intervene, his father nearly killed him. He kept the younger kids in line by wielding a hammer. And R. Jean was beginning to develop a sexual interest in his now teenage daughter, Loretta. But she had a personality that was less docile than Sheila, so she was able to fend him off. All the while, his rage toward Sheila for leaving him and taking the baby grew and grew. Then his son, Billy, who was now 19, also moved out and got married. This enraged R. Jean. He now prohibited the family who still lived with him from having any contact with Billy or Sheila. Next, Elgin, his oldest, who had moved out and had a baby daughter, ended up moving home again. But all the while, life at Mockingbird Hill remained miserable. R. Jean was someone who required absolute control on everyone around him. The military had given him that structure, authority, and dominance for 20 years. After retirement, losing it was devastating to his ego. And once again, everything began falling apart after fleeing New Mexico. He began viewing his family members as traitors. He censored their mail. He didn't allow them to socialize. He didn't allow them to use the phone. No one could leave without permission. He even insisted on driving his kids to and from the bus stop every single day, refusing to let them walk. He treated his children like military subordinates, forcing them to haul rocks up their steep hill whenever they weren't at school. In 1985, Arjean took a job at Woodline Motor Freight, and that's where he met Kathy Kendrick, the woman he shot first during the spree. He became infatuated with her, but Kathy rebuffed him. She was more than twice his age, married, with a child. She was not interested. He began showing up with flowers, cards, following her around the office. Their supervisor, Joyce Butts, the woman he later shot at Woodline, intervened, telling him to leave Kathy alone. He resented this deeply. He resented a woman having authority over him. He eventually quit Woodline, but as we know, he would later return with guns. He picked up a second job at the Sinclair Mini Mart, where he would also return during his rampage. Meanwhile, his wife, unbeknownst to him, began saving money to leave him. She was planning a divorce, but she didn't know how she would support herself. She hadn't worked since before marriage, and Simmons suspected she was planning to leave. In early 1987, feeling the loss of control, Arjean convened a family meeting. He even invited Sheila and her husband Dennis, his estranged daughter who had escaped him. He tried to reconcile. He tried to explain himself and his issues. None of the family members were receptive. Sheila and Dennis mock applauded him before getting up and leaving. This was devastating to him. This last-ditch effort to reassert control had failed. With two of his children out of the house, his wife was planning to leave, his inability to hold jobs, the home in filth, junk cars littering the yards, Arjean, who needed control, was losing everything. He wrote a note to Sheila, never sent it, and placed it in a safe deposit box. It began lovingly, "I want to start by saying, honey, I love you," and then spiraled into rage. "You have destroyed me. You have left me with no hope. You are my sunshine. You have caused me great pain. You are my biggest disappointment in life." He ends it with, "Goodbye, my precious sweetheart. Goodbye, my love. Goodbye, goodbye, goodbye." He never gave it to her. Instead, he added a note in the deposit box. Kathy Michael Kendrick was a contributing factor, and we know what that means now. On December 18th, 1987, Arjean quit his job at Sinclair Mini Mart, only to show up a week later to shoot the place up. In the midst of that multi-location, 40-minute shooting spree, two lives were claimed. And amazingly, everyone else who was shot that morning, his former boss Rusty Taylor, Mini Mart co-workers David Saylor and Roberta Woolry, and Joyce Butts, survived their gunshots. Once Arjean was in custody, police delved into his background and learned everything that I've told you so far. They learned about his large family, his wife, 7 children, 3 grandchildren, and that's when they realized the chore that lay ahead of them. It seems like an open and shut case, right? But I'm talking literally. What are police thinking? They got to get in touch with his family. They want to notify his wife, maybe interview family members. They thought maybe if they could talk to his family, they could learn a little bit more about why he'd done this. So investigator Jim Hardy, the Pope County Sheriff's Office, is sent to the Simmons home on Broomfield Lane, you know, the one called Mockingbird Hill. He finds the property quiet. There are cars out front, some broken down. He knocks on the door. No one answers. He checks around the property, calling out, "Anyone home?" Only silence. All the doors are locked. The curtains are drawn. He tries to pry open the sliding glass door, but it won't budge. Then he notices a broomstick had been placed on the track to prevent it from opening. Despite freezing temperatures, there's no smoke, no sign of firewood, no heating. Through a crack in the curtains behind the sliding glass door, he can vaguely see something on the floor covered with a blanket. At this point, Hardy returns to town and contacts teachers at the schools the Simmons children attend. He learns that none of the children had returned to school after Christmas break. Well, at this point, it's not looking good. After realizing the kids never returned to school, police pay a visit to Arjean in jail. They ask him for permission to search his home without a warrant. He shakes his head no. When they ask him about his missing family members, Simmons' lip begins to quiver and his eyes gloss over. But still, he says nothing. That's when they knew they needed to enter the home immediately. But it's Christmas break. The magistrates who could issue a warrant were on vacation. So the prosecutor's office gives them the green light to go ahead and enter the property. The team arrives at the property around 2:30 p.m. It's still quiet, just as Hardy had left it. They climb the long hill up to the home. They find all the windows locked except for one on the south side. Sheriff Jim Ballin lifts the window, pulls the curtain, and peeks inside. He sees a brightly decorated Christmas tree with presents underneath, and lying at the foot of the tree is the body of a young woman covered with a blue coat. He pokes his head inside. He looks around and sees other bodies in the kitchen area. He squeezes through the window and barely avoiding stumbling over the body of Sheila Simmons, his daughter. He removes the broomstick from the sliding glass door track, letting the others in. And inside, they find the bodies of four adults, each shot to death, covered up. Sheila had been shot 6 times in the face. Her husband, Dennis, was lying just inside the door. She once shot once in the face, covered with a comforter. In the kitchen area, covered in blankets, were Billy Simmons, age 22, shot twice in the head. Renata Simmons, his 21-year-old wife, shot 7 times in the head and neck. In one of the back bedrooms, they find a little girl, Sylvia, face down on the bed. The daughter that Sheila had with her father. She had been strangled to death. From what investigators would determine, these 7 members of Simmons' extended family had been invited to a holiday dinner at the house on December 26. They all showed up only to be ambushed, but that still left 7 family members unaccounted for. His wife Becky, his son Ronald Jr., 14-year-old Eddie, 17-year-old Loretta, 11-year-old Marianne, 8-year-old Rebecca, and his 3-year-old granddaughter Barbara. In one of the bedrooms, they found blood on the pillows, and another, blood all over the walls and ceiling. It was clearly a bloody frenzy had taken place. But where were the rest of the bodies? Investigators were exhausted. It was dark now, so they removed the bodies from the house, returned the next day to continue the search. The next day, while searching the backyard, 2 deputies noticed a patch of loose dirt covered with sheets of tin. They lift the metal and find a hole filled with rocks, barbed wire, moss, all signs of recent digging. And then the smell of kerosene. They keep digging. Underneath the rocks and barbed wire, they find 1 body, then another, and another. Stacked one on top of the other in their own backyard, they recover 7 bodies, all 7 missing family members. Simmons had poured kerosene into the grave to disguise the smell and keep animals away. Still missing, his 2 infant grandsons, Trey and Michael. So police pry open the trunks of 2 cars sitting on the property. Inside, in tightly wrapped garbage bags sealed with tape, they find both baby boys. And during this, R. Jean is just sitting in custody, not saying a word. Police begin piecing it together. At this point, with the grave uncovered and all 16 victims accounted for, police begin trying to reconstruct the timeline. It had all started on the morning of December 22nd, 5 days before the public rampage. That morning, R. Jean had gone to Walmart and purchased a .22-caliber handgun. He returned home and shot his wife in the head. Then he shot his 26-year-old son, Elgin, multiple times in the head and chest. But the bullets didn't kill him instantly. He fought back. So R. Jean took a steel pipe and bludgeoned him to death. Then he went into the bedroom of his 3-year-old granddaughter, Barbara, and killed her. After murdering those 3, he moved their bodies to the hole in the backyard, a hole that he had made his own children dig a few weeks earlier. He told them it was a cesspit for the outhouse, but he was having them dig their own graves. After dumping those bodies into the grave, he tore the cabinet doors off their hinges, maybe to stage a scene, maybe to fake a robbery, who knows. Then he sat and waited. He drank liquor, watched TV. A few hours later, his 4 youngest children returned home from school on the school bus. Their ages were Loretta 17, Eddie 14, Marianne 11, Rebecca 8. He picked them up from the bus stop, like always. It's believed he told them he had a special Christmas surprise for them, but he wanted to give it to them 1 by 1. He had the 3 youngest wait in the car, with Christmas music playing on the radio. Then he led Loretta inside. She would have immediately noticed how quiet the house was. No one else was home. No smells, no sounds. He took her into the bedroom and killed her. Then he went back to the car and repeated the process, bringing each child in 1 by 1, murdering each of them. Once he was finished, all 7 members of his household were dead. He sat down in front of the TV, drinking liquor. He moved the bodies of his 4 youngest children into the backyard grave with their mother, brother, and niece. That was December 22nd. For the next 4 days, he lived in that house. On December 26th, the day after Christmas, the rest of the family arrived for a holiday gathering. believing it was a normal visit. He first shot and killed Billy, his 22-year-old son, then Billy's wife, Renata, then their 20-month-old son. Once Sheila arrived with her husband, Dennis, he shot and killed them both. Then he strangled Sylvia, the daughter he'd fathered with Sheila. He clearly didn't feel anything. He killed 14 members of his own family. Most were children. Many were under the age of 3. He then murdered his 2 infant grandsons, Trey and Michael, stuffed them in garbage bags, placing their bodies in car trunks outside. Then he drove to Sears to pick up Christmas presents he had already ordered for his now dead family. He wrapped the gifts and arranged them neatly under the tree. That night, he went drinking at a bar. The next day, he stayed home again, drank, watched TV. There were 4 dead bodies lying around him inside the home. On Monday morning, December 28th, he woke up, went to Walmart, bought another .22 caliber gun, and launched his public rampage. He first shot and killed Kathy Kendrick at the law office, his former co-worker who had rejected him. Then he shot Rusty Taylor, Taylor Oil, and killed firefighter Jim Chaffin, the total stranger who was just walking in the door that morning. He tried to kill Julie Mone, the bookkeeper, but missed. Then he attacked Sinclair Mini Mart, shooting Roberto Woolery, David Saylor, but was fought off by Tony Carter, the elderly man with the Coca-Cola cans. Then he drove to Woodline Motor Freight, shot Joyce Butts, who had scolded him at work, and spared Vicky Jackson, allowing her to call police so he could surrender. Of all the people he attacked publicly, only 2 people died, Kathy Kendrick and Jim Chaffin. After the shootings, with Arjean Simmons now in custody and still not talking, investigators were left to piece the entire story together themselves. He was completely silent. He sat in his jail cot, stared at the wall, disassociating. He seemed catatonic at times. Because of this, he was transported to a local hospital for a psychiatric evaluation to determine if he was fit to stand trial. It was concluded that he was. In May of 1988, he was found guilty in the murders of Kathy Kendrick and Jim Chaffin. He was sentenced to death by lethal injection. After the sentence was handed down, he made this statement. I, Ronald Jean Simmons Sr., wanted to be known that it was my wish and desire that absolutely no action by anybody be taken to appeal or in any way change my sentence. It is further respectfully requested that the sentence be carried out quickly. He didn't want an appeal. He wanted to go through with the death sentence. Simmons went on trial again, this time for the 14 murders of his family members. During the trial, the letter he had written to Sheila, the one where he promised to see her in hell but never gave her, was entered into evidence. When that letter was introduced and ruled admissible by the judge, Simmons leapt out of his chair and punched the prosecutor in the face. Then he reached for the deputy's gun. Yes, he had to be restrained, was led out in chains, and put into a holding cell. At the trial's conclusion in February 1989, he was found guilty on all counts. Again, he was sentenced to death plus 147 years. Afterward, he refused to appeal the sentence. In another statement, he said, quote, to those who oppose the death penalty, in my particular case, anything short of death would be cruel and unusual punishment. This triggered a competency hearing to determine whether Simmons was in his right mind enough to waive his right to appeal. The court ruled he was. The appeal was waived. During his time on death row, Simmons was mostly kept in isolation. Why? Because other prisoners were threatening to kill him constantly. And again, I think this case really hit my limit. He killed 14 family members, 16 people total, injured many more, and some of the ones he killed were toddlers, some under the age of 3. On June 25th, 1990, Ronald Jean Simmons was executed by lethal injection, only 911 days after the murders began. He became just the 2nd person executed in Arkansas since the national ban on executions was lifted in 1976, and that's an extremely fast execution. His execution warrant was signed by then-governor of Arkansas, Bill Clinton. None of R. Jean Simmons' surviving relatives claimed his body, so he was buried in a pauper's grave, an unmarked grave for the unwanted and unclaimed. And that is the story of Ronald Jean Simmons, who, during the week of Christmas, went on a murdering rampage, killing 14 members of his family, plus 2 more in public shootings, injuring many others. It remains to this day the worst family annihilation in U.S. history, which I, for one, hope is a record that is never broken. And this episode is brought to you by Fastest VPN. Look, the internet can feel like a wild carnival sometimes. Bright lights, spinning wheels, and at least 3 shady dudes lurking behind the funnel cake stand trying to steal your data. So if you're online as much as the rest of us, you need a layer of armor. That's why Festus VPN rolls in like a digital bouncer. This thing gives you full online protection, keeps you browsing private, and blocks trackers faster than you hit skip ad on a 30-second pre-roll. And for Black Friday, you can get lifetime protection for 93% off. Yeah, one purchase, forever protection. No renewing, no surprise charges, straight up peace of mind. With Festus VPN, you get encryption strong enough to fend off digital snoops, access to servers around the world, malware protection, and speeds that don't drag your streaming down into a lag town. Whether you're working, streaming, gaming, traveling, or just avoiding your ISP's judgmental stare, Festus VPN has you covered. So hit the link in the description and grab that 93% lifetime deal before it ends. And lock down your digital world for good. Festus VPN, one purchase, lifetime protection. And with that, let me know your thoughts on this case in the comments section below. And if you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS. As always, thank you so much for watching and listening. We will see you in our next episode.
Did you know Microsoft has officially ended support for Windows 10? Upgrade to Windows 11 with an LG Gram laptop. Voted PC Mag's Reader's Choice Top Laptop Brand for 2025. Thin and ultra lightweight, the LG Gram keeps you productive anywhere. And Windows 11 gives you access to free security updates and ongoing feature upgrades. Visit lgusa.com/iHeart for great seasonal savings on LG Gram laptops with Windows 11. PC Mag Reader's Choice used with permission. All rights reserved.